welcome to the second edition of Media Twits. I'm Mark Glazer, executive editor of PBS Media Shift, and I have Rafat Ali, who's founder of Paid Content, joining as co-host again today. Hey, Rafat, how's it going?
Hey, Mark, how's it going? It's going well. It's been a busy news week.
Yeah, it's been pretty busy lately. There's a lot flying at us. I guess this I'll just give a quick rundown of what we'll be talking about on the show, just so people have an idea of our topics. Our biggest topic is AT&T has said it's going to buy out T-Mobile USA for $39 billion if they can get regulatory approval. We're also going to be talking to the editors of a new book called Tweets from Tahrir, which is actually shipping today from Or Books at orbooks.com. So we'll be talking to the editors Nadia Idol and Alex Nunes. And then we'll get back to what we talked about in the first episode, which is the New York Times paywall, and what the reaction has been to that, and how the New York Times has actually already changed some of the rules around that, and also look at the poll results from people on Media Shift as far as whether they'd pay for New York Times. So let's get at it with AT&T and T-Mobile. This is a pretty big deal on Wall Street. I mean, first of all, it's just a big deal because there's actually big buyouts happening again. That hasn't happened for a while.
Exactly. What was your first reaction, Mark, when you heard of it? Were you a customer of either of them?
Yeah, I'm a customer of AT&T with an iPhone, and I have been for a few years. And I'm actually getting ready to switch to Verizon for my iPhone because I'm just so tired of just having drop calls and just having horrible service here in San Francisco where I live. I actually even wrote a song called the iPhone Blues about
remember that, yeah.
I got my iPhone, baby. Can't get a signal at all. Got my iPhone, baby. Can't get a signal at all. Even here in San Francisco at my home, I can't make a phone call.
I've had AT&T, it's been frustrating. And I guess they're saying that with this deal, I mean, AT&T and T-Mobile would be the biggest cell service, right? T-Mobile's number four.
Correct.
Verizon's number one. So it's basically number two and number four hooking up to try to become number one.
Yeah, correct. And I used to be on T-Mobile for years, and then I moved to AT&T. About a year and a half ago, actually a year ago, to go with iPhone 3GS when it came out.
And so what was your experience with T-Mobile versus AT&T? Like, I'm curious, was your access pretty good on T-Mobile?
Well, but back with that, this was when I was living in LA. I had unlocked Nokia phones that I could use, the multimedia ones that they used to give to all these journalists. I'm sure you had one too, those N90s or N80s, whatever they called it.
Oh, yeah, and the blogger
which had
phones.
The blogger phones and stuff. So I was part of that crowd. And so because it was unlocked on GSM, and T-Mobile, I think, was the cheapest at that point, or they were among the cheaper compared to AT&T. So that's why I was on T-Mobile. And then when iPhone 3GS came out, I didn't go to AT&T when the first iPhone came out. I used it just to test and write about it, but not to actually for my daily stuff. And then I moved to AT&T. I think what has happened since I in the last year and a half since I've been here, their service has certainly, their network has certainly improved. This is AT&T.
Yeah.
And so I'm hoping that with T-Mobile has a lot of redundant network capacity, and they just won some auction on the spectrum as well. So hopefully that means that the network will get much better. What it means for competition and stuff that's being debated as we're speaking, it's going to take at least a year, if not more, for the merger to go through, if it happens, if it gets regulatory improvements and stuff. So it's a while off. So if anybody's looking to change, I would say wait. Change from AT&T or T-Mobile, I would say wait for about 6 months and see where the merger is going. And from there on.
Yeah, I mean, people can't expect that things are going to change overnight. Now, there's a whole thing about the towers, too, that supposedly this will be better infrastructure for AT&T in spots where they're possibly missing out.
Yeah, the other thing that's being debated quite a lot from a media perspective, from news media perspective, is how advertising money that used to be from two different operators, which is a big part of advertising revenues for newspapers and websites and stuff, how that's going to go away because it's just going to merge into one. So,
yeah. So it's less. Basically, you're saying it's going to be less advertising for newspapers, magazines, all the different media companies that were depending on what, four big advertisers, and maybe even five if you include someone like a Metro PCS.
Was doing, yeah. I mean, imagine, and you can see their ads everywhere. That's the whole point about mobile services. All of these Verizon, Sprint, AT&T, T-Mobile, they spend very, very heavily in media. And so there's another blow for media right there. So while that has nothing to do with media, it's just that advertising that they're that they used to spend so heavily. And will it potentially lead to some of the other existing players, the other existing players merging? That's going to be it's going to be even worse for the media companies. So I don't think they're very happy about it.
Yeah, and right after this, there was a lot of chit-chat that Verizon was going to buy up Sprint to basically, you know, say, well, you know, we'll one-up you with this deal. Although Verizon basically has denied that. And then that kind of led to Sprint coming into the arms of Google. You know, they announced a deal. I don't know if it was in the works coming up to this or whether it was afterwards, but now Sprint is saying that it will be using Google Voice on all of its phones. You have to have kind of a $70 plan on Sprint in order to use it, but you'll be able to use kind of the Google Voice, which is a pretty interesting service that, you know, lets you kind of route your calls to any phone. It lets you listen or read your voicemail messages online. Have you played around with Google Voice at all?
Yeah, I was among the early ones before they bought, I'm forgetting what company they bought. They bought some company and then that moved over to, oh, this was Grand Central Communications that they bought over and then moved over to Google Voice. So I had an account from then. I've never really used it. I don't have two or three different phone numbers, so I haven't had the urge to do it. So yeah, I haven't played with it that much. I don't foresee myself using it that much, but I can see how a lot of people, especially who are very mobile and have multiple phone numbers, could potentially be using it. I'm sure the deal was in works from before. My guess is that's been going on for a while. But Google, I think Google Voice's MO is to make sure that it's available everywhere, not just Sprint. So I don't know if it's going to be an exclusive deal for a while or it's just going to be integrated a lot closer than some of the other operators or just having an app on, say, iPhone or things like that. So it'd be interesting to see how users take to it.
Yeah, it's true. And Google, you know, they want to be everywhere. They're promiscuous when it comes to cell coverage and Android. They really do. But they did also make this announcement that their 4G Nexus phone will also be on Sprint. So I guess Sprint's getting a little bit of love because it's being left out of this merger deal. There was talk that Sprint was going to be the one merging with T-Mobile, which in a way would have made three very strong contenders versus what could be two really strong contenders, leaving Sprint left out, I guess.
Yeah, and also keep in mind Verizon is getting the iPhone as well, so I guess Sprint had to make some move to do something that keeps them on the map. So I suppose maybe Google will become a lot closer to Sprint. Maybe that's the next move.
Yeah. So what are you going to do? Are you going to hang on to AT&T and iPhone, or what are you thinking?
I don't know. I don't want to. I don't. I'm not too religious about the whole thing. For Manhattan, they have gotten much better, surprisingly, AT&T, and I'm gonna stick to it for now. I have a Vonage phone at home, and if I really need clear voice, that's what I use. If I'm calling from, if I'm calling family or something like that. But for most of the business stuff, AT&T works. For now, it works fine, so I'm sticking to it. What about you?
Oh, I'm going to switch over to Verizon for my iPhone. That's my take. I mean, the one downside is in international travel, it won't work. It won't work. But and a lot of people I know are kind of holding off. They have AT&T iPhones, and they're either under the belief that because everyone's switching to Verizon, the AT&T network will get better, or they're waiting for the
That's what they're
iPhone
saying.
5 in June. So it's all kind of a game of waiting and contracts and what the timing is with everything, right?
Yeah. I mean, when I travel abroad, which I travel a lot, I have a Google Nexus phone that is unlocked, of course, and then I just buy local SIMs. And I travel a lot to UK, so I have a UK SIM that I use when I get there, and that's a permanent number when I get there. So I think that way you can avoid some of the charges and stuff like that.
Okay, let's now move to the Tweets from Tahrir book, and I will now attempt to bring in Alex Nuns.
Hello.
Hey, Alex.
Hey.
Hello.
Hey, Nadia.
Hi.
How are you both doing?
Good.
Great, thanks.
Glad to have you on with us on MediaTwit. I also have Rafat Ali on.
Hey
Great.
guys, how are you?
Hi.
Hi.
So it's first tell us about where you are right now. Are you both based in London? And just I guess today's an exciting day. This is your release date or the shipping date of your book, right?
Yeah.
So we're both based in London. Nadia is half Egyptian, and so she was in Tahrir Square during the revolution. I'm just an English guy who was following Twitter.
Yeah, what? So, I mean, tell us a little bit about how this book came about. Obviously, you're both big Twitter fanatics. Nadia, being half Egyptian, would be of interest to you. Was it something? Had you been on Twitter for a long time?
I was just basically in London at work 24 hours a day watching the situation unfold. Obviously watching Al Jazeera and other channels for the pictures, but we found that, I was finding out more about what was actually happening on a minute by minute basis on Twitter. So I was watching things unfold, and then it came to the 6th of February, and I thought, I can't take it anymore. I've got to be there. So I just bought a plane ticket and went. And then Alex, in the meantime, was in the UK. I don't know if you want to say that part, Alex.
Well, I mean, I was watching it on the TV, on the news, like everyone was. But I thought that the best stuff that I could find was on Twitter, because I was turning to Twitter and I was following certain activists that I knew about who were in Egypt. And what they were saying was just so completely extraordinary that it made you feel like you were there. And it also struck me that it was quite historically important. And so that's why I thought at that point, somebody should be documenting this. Somebody should be making it into a book so it doesn't just disappear and vanish into cyberspace.
Yeah, and so tell us how you put the book together, because obviously there are so many people writing on Twitter about what was going on in Egypt. And this is basically late January, early February that this all took place, right?
So, I mean, you're right. There were loads of people tweeting. It would be impossible to try to be comprehensive, to try to cover everything that was tweeted and everyone that was tweeting. So our approach was just to focus on a core group of tweeters who told the story well, to try to get the word out about what had happened. And so we don't make any claim to have covered everything, to have included everyone. We've just selected, basically, there are just less than 20 in the core group, and then there are about 60 in the whole book who describe what's going on.
And in terms of the process, this is Rafa. In terms of the process, so you guys decided you want to do this, and then how did you go about contacting publishers and stuff like that?
Again, one for Alex.
Well, I just happen to know one of my friends is the daughter of Colin Robinson, who runs Orbooks in New York. So it was just completely who you know. It was there was nothing more complicated than that. I just phoned up my friend and I said, I've got this idea for a book. Do you think your dad would want to do it? And she told him about it, and he phoned me up and he said, oh, I'm really excited. This, nobody's done anything like this before. So that's how it came about.
And Nadia, how long were you in Egypt? Were you there through the whole revolution?
No, I was there for what could be called the good bit, I guess. So good as in I got there on the morning of the Tuesday, I think the 7th or the 8th of February, and I was there until the 14th. So I spent every day in Tahrir, and then I was there for the fall of Mubarak, which was absolutely amazing, but I did miss what a lot of my friends and family and activists went through during the blackout, the internet blackout, and the violence that took place, obviously. So, right. Yeah, I was there for the good bit.
And did you, were you, by the time you were there, you said the internet was restored, and were you tweeting from there?
No, I wasn't. I just wanted to be part of it myself. I felt like Twitter was something that I was following while I was in the UK, but when I was there, I was basically on the ground, just taking in the atmosphere and helping out in Tahrir and being part of it.
Did you, this is Mark, did you get to meet with some of the tweeters that you had quoted in the book when you were in Egypt?
I mean, yeah, obviously when I was there, the idea for the book hadn't come to me yet because I only found out about Alex's idea when I got back to London. But while I was there, I met quite a lot of people, a couple of whom I'd known already through activist circles. But I did meet a lot of people that later I went back and contacted and said, hey, I wonder if you remember me. We met on this date. It would be great to use your tweets. So that's kind of how it happened.
Yeah. Oh yeah, that's an interesting actually point that you raised. What were the sort of copyright issues in the sense that you had to take tweets? What kind of permissions did you have to get all these tweets in the book?
Our approach was that because we were doing this to support the revolution, we just wanted to inspire people with what happened. The legal issue didn't really arise for us because we went to every single tweeter who's in the book and said, would you mind if we used your tweets? And absolutely all of them who we've used were enthusiastic and supportive and said, yes, please, you know, I'd love to be a part of it. So I think there's a legal debate about what the copyright status is of tweets. I don't know if it's resolved, but I think, you know, there's one school of thought that they're in the public domain and you don't even need permission. But that wasn't relevant to us because we wanted to do it with people's support. It would have been absurd to do a book in support of the revolution against the wishes of the people who did it.
That makes sense. What about you're giving some of the proceeds to activists, or can you tell us a little bit about how the profits will work from this book?
Yeah, well, Orbooks is a small progressive publisher, and they like to support the people who are writing for them or editing their books. And so from the outset, Colin said, I want to put some proceeds aside to support the movement in Egypt. Because we've just sent the book to print and we haven't started discussing finances yet, we're not exactly sure what that amount is. However, the important thing is how do we support groups there that are still forming themselves, many of them, some of them are established, but also make sure that we're not compromising the sovereignty of their campaigns. Because one of the main criticisms that groups had in Egypt, or one of the easy ways to open themselves to criticism, is to accept funds from the West, where they easily be accused of, you know, not being Egyptian and taking foreign monies and being agents of, you know, foreign control and all the rest of it. And because the revolution is still new and there's still loads of, you know, issues and problems to be resolved with civil society and the democratic process, it's still a difficult time. So we've kept it deliberately vague until the dust settled a little. And what we were going to do, hopefully next week, is contact all the tweeters and say, hey guys, where do you think this cash should go? Is there a foundation? Is there a group? Is there a campaign that would benefit from a donation from us, but also not be put in a difficult political situation by receiving those funds?
One thing I noticed is that it doesn't seem like you identify who they are. You don't kind of give a rundown. I don't believe, you know, basically saying this is who they are, this is where they work, this is what they do. Is there a reason for that?
Well, I mean, part of the approach we took to the book was to make it like Twitter itself. So when you're on Twitter, you can follow people. You don't necessarily know where they work. You don't necessarily know their full name and so on. And we didn't think that it was necessary to really change that. I mean, you can get a sense as you read the book. You get a sense of these people's personalities and their approach. And so, I mean, some of the people in the book are professional journalists. There's a guy called Ashraf Khalil, who's a professional journalist, and his tweets are quite measured and very objective. And then there are others who are, you know, 100% activists who are in the square saying, come to Tahrir Square because we're being attacked. And obviously people can go on the web, they can look people up, and if the tweeters want people to know who they are, it's not hard to find out.
Yeah, and I noticed that you also have Hosni Mubarak's Twitter feed, which is obviously like a fake Twitter feed in there as well.
Yeah, it's very funny.
He's a star. We really love that guy, whoever he is.
Does anyone know who that is? Did that person reveal themselves yet or not?
Yeah, because we contacted them for permission. There's actually two. There's Hosni Mubarak and there's not Hosni Mubarak. And I know that not Hosni Mubarak is actually in America. I'm not sure which country Hosni Mubarak's in, but yeah, we've been in contact with them. We know who they are.
Okay. But the world at large doesn't know who they are still.
No.
Okay. I'm also curious what you guys think about the current situation in Egypt. Do you feel like it's something where... I'm not sure what it's like in the UK, but at least in the US, it feels like everyone's just changed their attention, and now we're talking about Libya and other things, and no one's really following up to find out, you know, how is everything going on in Egypt? Is that similar in the UK?
I think it is in terms of the mainstream coverage, for sure. It kind of depends on where you get your news from, I guess. If you're on Twitter and you've got the hashtag Jan 25, especially today, you'll find there's a lot that's going on in Egypt because the cabinet has just voted to bring in a law to criminalize protests and you know, the sort of actions that people have been taking, and strikes and protests, basically, that's a huge move, which has angered a lot of people and called for a whole lot of other demonstrations. So basically, the way I look at it is that overall, it's a democratic process being born, and it's going through birthing pains at the moment with all of those problems of setting up a democratic state. So it's in no way over. There are still huge issues in terms of the relationship between the state and the grassroots and civil society. But I guess because the action, so to speak, is not happening and unfolding in the same way that it is in Libya or Bahrain, yes, of course, it's gone off the mainstream radar at the moment. But the activists are still paying attention. I am, definitely.
What are your plans in terms of trying to figure out how to get the word out, besides, I guess, media helping you do it? Have you thought of distribution beyond, I guess, Kindle and electron? And are you doing physical distribution as well?
Yeah, there will be physical books. All books. The publisher in New York is a new kind of publisher where they print on demand. So basically, once they get in 100 orders or whatever, they print 100 books. And I think most of their sales are still books, but obviously they do e-books as well. But the amount of attention it's had from the media, I mean, you know, today on PBS, and there's New York Times, The New Yorker, there's media in Italy, there's media in the UK. There's been plenty of attention for the book. So I think there's going to be no problem in people finding out about it.
And I assume you'll be using Twitter as well.
Absolutely, yeah.
And people seem really excited about it in Egypt. If nothing else, when I plan to go there in May, I don't know if it's going to be possible yet, but I'm going to take a whole load with me and make sure that Twitter gets one.
Oh, that's a question. Is it going to be in sale in Egypt?
Well, at the moment, we're looking into different, or Orbooks, Colin at Orbooks is looking into the different distribution possibilities. We're just kind of trying to take our breath, but yes, absolutely, I want to see it in Egypt as soon as possible.
I mean, it's actually available worldwide now because everybody has to order it from allbooks.com. It's only available online. So anybody in the world can order it from allbooks.com and they'll send it through the post.
Yeah, and just so everyone knows, it's Orbooks is O-R-B-O-O-K-S.com. And if you go to their website, that's basically the main point of buying the book. And I guess it'll be on Kindle as well. But it won't be, let's say, if you go to Barnes & Noble in the U.S. or you go to a bookstore, you might not see it. You really have to go to the website to get it, right?
Initially, yeah.
Just for now. But that will change over time.
It might do. I mean, that's up to the publisher, you know. It could get reprinted and so on.
Well, thanks a lot, guys. I really appreciate you joining us. And stay in touch. Let us know how it goes.
Thank you very much.
Fascinating thing, the book, this whole idea behind that. I mean, one of the things is this whole, printing on demand, the idea of that, that alone is a pretty fascinating idea, right?
Yeah, and it's the interesting part is that it's becoming quite possible to market it a lot better than, let's say, what it was. Like, print on demand on the web has been available for, what, like 7-10 years now?
Yeah.
But only now, because of electronic ebook and e-readers and the associated online marketing through various channels, is when it's become a lot more possible. An example that actually very close to the Arab Revolution that happened was a magazine, Foreign Policy, through their website foreignpolicy.com. They were among the first to predict the Arab Revolution, I think about a year ago, or was it 2 years ago, through an article from one of their star analysts that wrote an article about it. And they, within a week of the revolution, of Egypt Revolution happening, put together a package of stories. And they came out with an ebook that they're selling through the website as well as Kindle. And that's been fascinating, that all of this stuff... Their book is not in print, as opposed to them, the tweets from Tahrir. But for the first time, you can actually see it possible happening.
Yeah, I think that's another subject that comes up a lot on Media Shift, and I'm sure we'll talk about it more too, is just the way the book publishing world is really changing. I mean, you think about when you used to produce a book, you know, you'd write the book, you'd turn it in a certain time, and what? It wouldn't hit the bookshelves for at least a year, if not more, just to get that whole marketing and printing machine and everything, distribution all together. And now there's so much being cut out in the middle.
Yeah, and I think the timeline for a lot of these books are still that long. I mean, some of the more mainstream books, I do think that there's no way that window, that timeline will stay and will have to compress by the time a book comes out, if it's a year late, especially if it's a nonfiction book. It will have to change, and I'm sure that's what the book industry is dealing with right now, especially when stuff like this happens, tweets from Tahrir and the Foreign Policy book and the WikiLeaks books that Guardian as well as the New York Times put out as well, which are quite instant books.
Yeah, it's amazing. You think about it, that this is January 25 was the initial large protest in Cairo, and then, you know, everything happened in February, and we're now just March, and they're shipping the book today. So that's a really fast turnaround. The last thing we'll talk about is the New York Times paywall that we discussed last episode, that is going to go into effect on March 28th for the U.S. It's already in effect in Canada, so the cheats have already, you know, pushed forward and figured out ways to get through to the content, to get around the wall. And now the New York Times is saying they had a limit on Google links into the site of 5, I think, per day, and now that limit is going to be extended to Twitter and Facebook links as well. And you got to hear Janet Robinson, the CEO of New York Times, talk recently.
Yeah, this morning, actually, Arthur Sulzberger and the CEO of the New York Times company, Janet Robinson, both of them spoke at an event this morning, and it was webcast, and I was listening into it. And this thing is going to give fodder to media people for the next, I don't know how many years. This is a gold mine for people in the media industry. And it will be interesting to see when March 28th, I guess, just in like 2 weeks, when we from now, as to what the reaction will be. There have been a lot of hacks, as you said. There was a Twitter. There have been a bunch of Twitter hacks already, and New York Times has started to clamp down on some of them. And also, there was a Firefox extension, was it, that got rid of the 20 article limit or something like that, Mark?
Yeah, there's a JavaScript code that you could do that was, I think Neiman Lab ran something that said, you know, four lines of JavaScript would basically get rid of the wall and allow you to see whatever story it is you wanted to see.
Yeah, and I think this is the point that Arthur Sulzberger was making as well, and he was slightly more forceful and glib than I would have been about how only unemployed people or teenagers will be the ones that are going to do these hacks and will care about going past the paywall. I think that's a little glib. But I do agree with the general sentiment that I think there's more noise than actual action in terms of people trying to get around it. And I'm more optimistic on the paywall or on their schemes, on their premium schemes, than some of the other media people.
You're more optimistic. You think that more people will pay than people say.
Yeah, and I also think that, I mean, this was happening in the last week since we last talked, Mark, about the four New York Times journalists that were caught in Libya, and then they were released 2 days ago. And actually this morning I was reading the article that came out about their whole experience, and it's just it's a fascinating and bone chilling account of what they went through. And it is clear the kind of journalism that they do, and I think really their best marketing is the quality of their journalism. And while that may sound more naive and sort of idealistic than it is, I do think a lot of people who do read it, they're loyalists, as they call it, which they say is about 800,000 people in print. They will get the web for free anyway, but I do think a lot of people on the web who read it, and also they're loyalists, will pay up. I mean, I'm more hopeful. I don't know about where you stand at this point.
Yeah, I agree. I think people do want to support them. I'm hopeful that they can come up with some kind of pay scheme. I just don't think this is the right scheme. I just think that the prices were just too high. I would agree a little bit more with what Steve Outing was saying last week, which is that, you know, you've set the price a little bit too high. I think there are a lot of people who are willing to say, oh, I see that they're doing some really excellent journalism. I'm willing to support them in some way. You know, what can I do a $99 a year membership type of thing that Salon did and I think was relatively successful with to some extent. But something that's a little bit better price, I think just the $15 to $35 a month, that just seems a little bit steep. Let me just quickly go through on the negative aspect of it. We did a poll at MediaShift, obviously not scientific, but it got a pretty big response, especially out of the PBS Facebook fan page. It was posted there. It has about 400 votes, and you know, we asked, would you pay for nytimes.com? 49%, just about half, said no way. 28% said only if they bring the price down, which is what I was talking about. 9% said they would pay the $15 a month for web and smartphone app, and just 2.5% said they'd pay the $20 a month for web and tablet app, and only one person said they'd pay $35 a month.
I would be interested to find out what the exact equivalent. I'm sure they did their service on their end as well, right? And I would be very interested to see what their number was versus what your number was and what some of the other surveys are out there. on it. So it'd be interesting to see what, and of course it's not representative, as you said.
Yeah, well, you know, we as media twits, of course, are going to be talking about this paywall for a long time. And, you know, the Dallas Morning News has now put in a paywall as well. And there are a lot of other people, you know, the Wall Street Journal is having, you know, charges for everything that you do along the line. So there's a lot of the pay model is certainly in flux. And there's a lot being tried and a lot of people seeing what sticks. So, you know, who knows what's going to work and what's not. And we're still pretty much in a recession. So to get people to pay extra for something that they got for free, that's hard.
Yeah, but the one thing that I do like about the debate that's happening is that, or at least these companies trying it this way, and all kinds of companies are trying various ways. The Daily, as you know, is only on the iPad. And other companies are trying to, is the nuances that are coming out of it and the variety of business models that are coming out of it, as opposed to shutting down the site. Here's either you pay or completely free. So the nuances of the models that are coming out is what I'm sort of more heartened by than anything else.
Yeah, that it's not so, just it's not just an either or pay or you don't get anything. At least this is a meter wall, right?
Yeah, and it's there's a lot of as they call themselves. It is a leaky wall from social media, from search and others as well. So, I do think that we will, and user behavior will change as a result, whether through the, if a marquee brand like New York Times or whether through, I mean, we've already seen user behavior change through, I guess, the paywall of Apple. I mean, that's a paywall as well. So. So you will see a lot more changes in consumer behavior, which is somebody watching media and media consumption. It's just a fascinating time to be watching this.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Media Twits with co-host Rafat Ali. I'm Mark Glazer. And thanks to our guests, Nadia Eidel and Alex Nunes, the authors of the book Tweets from Tahrir, which is out on orbooks.com. And if you want to keep up with all the news, events, and polls, check out PBS MediaShift at pbs.org/MediaShift and our sister blog Idea Lab at pbs.org/Idea Lab.